The engine purred all the time. Jesus, he built that up wonderfully. It's just like him to think of a detail like that. It's one of those little details which makes a thing psychologically real. You can't get it out of your head afterward, and he tells it to me so smoothly, so naturally. I wonder, did he think it up in advance, or did it just pop out of his head like that, spontaneously? He's such a cute little liar, you can't walk away from him. It's like he's writing you a letter, one of those flower pots that he makes overnight. I don't understand how a guy can write such letters. I don't get the mentality behind it. It's a form of masturbation. What do you think? But before I have an opportunity to venture an opinion, or even to laugh in his face, Van Norden goes on with his monologue. Listen, I suppose he told you everything. Did he tell you how he stood on the balcony in the moonlight and kissed her? That sounds banal when you repeat it, but the way that guy describes it, I can just see the little prick, standing there with the woman in his arms, and already he's writing another letter to her, another flower pot about the rooftops and all that crap he steals from his French authors. That guy never says a thing that's original, I found that out. You have to get a clue, like, find out whom he's been reading lately, and it's hard to do that because he's so damned secretive. Listen, if I didn't know that you went there with him, I wouldn't believe that the woman existed. A guy like that could write letters to himself. And yet he's lucky. He's so damn tiny, so frail, so romantic-looking that women fall for him now and then. They sort of adopt him. They feel sorry for him, I guess. And some cunts like to receive flower pots. It makes them feel important. But this woman's an intelligent woman, so he says. You ought to know. You've seen her letters. What do you suppose a woman like that saw in him? I can understand her falling for the letters, but how do you suppose she felt when she saw him? But listen, all that's beside the point. What I'm getting at is the way he tells it to me. You know how he embroiders things. Well, after that scene on the balcony, he gives me that like an hors d'oeuvre, you know? After that, so he says, they went inside and he unbuttoned her pajamas. What are you smiling for? Was he shitting me about that? No, no, you're giving it to me exactly as he told me. Go ahead. After that, here Van Norden has to smile himself. After that, mind you, he tells me how she sat in the chair with her legs up, not a stitch on. And he's sitting on the floor looking up at her, telling her how beautiful she looks. Did he tell you that she looked like a Matisse? Wait a minute, I'd like to remember exactly what he said. He had some cute little phrase there about an odalisque. What the hell's an odalisque, anyway? He said it in French, that's why it's hard to remember the fucking thing, but it sounded good. It sounded just like the sort of thing he might say, and she probably thought it was original with him. I suppose she thinks he's a poet or something, but listen, all this is nothing. I make allowance for his imagination. It's what happened after that that drives me crazy. All night long I've been tossing about, playing with these images he left in my mind. I can't get it out of my head. It sounds so real to me that if it didn't happen, I could strangle the bastard. A guy has no right to invent things like that, or else he's diseased. What I'm getting at is that moment when he says he got down on his knees and with those two skinny fingers of his, he spread her cunt open. You remember that? He says she was sitting there with her legs dangling over the arms of the chair, and suddenly, he says, he got an inspiration. This was after he had given her a couple of lays already, after he had made that little spiel about Matisse. He gets down on his knees, get this, and with his two fingers, just the tips of them, mind you, he opens the little petals, squish, squish, just like that, a sticky little sound, almost inaudible, squish, squish. Jesus, I've been hearing it all night long. And then he says, as if that weren't enough for me, then he tells me he buried his head in her muff. And when he did that, so help me Christ, if she didn't swing her legs around his neck and lock him there, that finished me. Imagine it. Imagine a fine, sensitive woman like that swinging her legs around his neck. There's something poisonous about it. It's so fantastic that it sounds convincing. If he had only told me about the champagne and the ride in the Bois and even that scene on the balcony, I could have dismissed it. But this thing is so incredible that it doesn't sound like a lie anymore. I can't believe that he ever read anything like that anywhere, and I can't see what could have put the idea into his head unless there was some truth in it. With a little prick like that, you know, anything can happen. He may not have fucked her at all, but she may have let him diddle her. You never know with these rich cunts what they might expect you to do. When he finally pulls himself out of bed and starts to shave, the afternoon is already well advanced. I've finally succeeded in switching his mind to other things, to the moving, principally. The maid comes in to see if he's ready. He's supposed to have vacated the room by noon. He's just in the act of slipping into his trousers. I'm a little surprised that he doesn't excuse himself or turn away. Seeing him standing there nonchalantly buttoning his fly as he gives her orders, I begin to titter. "Don't mind her," he says, throwing her a look of supreme contempt. "She's just a big sow. Give her a pinch in the ass if you like. She won't say anything." And then addressing her in English, he says, "Come here, you bitch. Put your hand on this." At this, I can't restrain myself any longer. I burst out laughing, a fit of hysterical laughter which infects the maid also, though she doesn't know what it's all about. The maid commences to take down the pictures and the photographs, mostly of himself, which line the walls. "You," he says, jerking his thumb, "come here. Here's something to remember me by," ripping a photograph off the wall. "When I go, you can wipe your ass with it." "See," he says, turning to me, "she's a dumb bitch. She wouldn't look any more intelligent if I said it in French." The maid stands there with her mouth open. She is evidently convinced that he is cracked. "Hey," he yells at her, as if she were hard of hearing. "Hey, you! Yes, you! Like this!" And he takes the photograph, his own photograph, and wipes his ass with it. "Comme ça? Savvy?" "You've got to draw pictures for her," he says, thrusting his lower lip forward in absolute disgust. He watches her helplessly as she throws his things into the big valises. "Here, put these in too," he says, handing her a toothbrush and the douchebag. Half of his belongings are lying on the floor. The valises are crammed full, and there is nowhere to put the paintings and the books and the bottles that are half empty. "Sit down a minute," he says. "We've got plenty of time. We've got to think this thing out. If you hadn't come around, I'd never have gotten out of here. You see how helpless I am. Don't let me forget to take the bulbs out. They belong to me. That wastebasket belongs to me, too. They expect you to live like pigs, these bastards." The maid has gone downstairs to get some twine. "Wait till you see. She'll charge me for the twine, even if it's only 3 sous. They wouldn't sew a button on your pants here without charging for it, the lousy, dirty scroungers." He takes a bottle of Calvados from the mantelpiece and nods to me to grab the other. "No use carrying these to the new place. Let's finish them off now. Don't give her a drink. That bastard, I wouldn't leave her a piece of toilet paper. I'd like to ruin the joint before I go. Listen, piss on the floor if you like. I wish I could take a crap in the bureau drawer." He feels so utterly disgusted with himself and everything else that he doesn't know what to do by way of venting his feelings. He walks over to the bed with the bottle in his hand, and pulling back the covers, he sprinkles Calvados over the mattress. Not content with that, he digs his heel into the mattress. Unfortunately, there's no mud on his heels. Finally, he takes the sheet and cleans his shoes with it. "That'll give them something to do," he mutters vengefully. Then, taking a good swig, he throws his head back and gargles his throat, and after he's gargled it good and proper, he spits it out on the mirror. "There, you cheap bastards. Wipe that off when I go." He walks back and forth, mumbling to himself. Seeing his torn socks lying on the floor, he picks them up and tears them to bits. The paintings enrage him, too. He picks one up, a portrait of himself done by some lesbian he knew, and he puts his foot through it. "That bitch. You know what she had the nerve to ask me? She asked me to turn over my cunts to her after I was through with them. She never gave me a sou for writing her up. She thought I honestly admired her work. I wouldn't have gotten that painting out of her if I hadn't promised to fix her up with that cunt from Minnesota. She was nuts about her. Used to follow us around like a dog in heat. We couldn't get rid of the bitch. She bothered the life out of me. I got so that I was almost afraid to bring a cunt up here for fear that she'd bust in on me. I used to creep up here like a burglar and lock the door behind me as soon as I got inside. She and that Georgia cunt, they drive me nuts. The one is always in heat and the other is always hungry. I hate fucking a woman who's hungry. It's like you push a feed inside her and then you push it out again. Jesus, that reminds me of something. Where did I put that blue ointment? That's important. Did you ever have those things? It's worse than having a dose. I don't know where I got them from either. I've had so many women up here in the last week or so I've lost track of them. Funny, too, because they all smelled so fresh. But you know how it is." The maid has piled his things up on the sidewalk. The patron looks on with a surly air. When everything has been loaded into the taxi, there is only room for one of us inside. As soon as we commence to roll, Van Norden gets out a newspaper and starts bundling up his pots and pans. In the new place, all cooking is strictly forbidden. By the time we reach our destination, all his luggage has come undone. It wouldn't be quite so embarrassing if the madam had not stuck her head out of the doorway just as we rolled up. "My God," she exclaims. "What in the devil is all this? What does it mean?" Van Norden is so intimidated that he can think of nothing more to say than, c'est moi, madame. And turning to me, he mumbles savagely, "That cluck. Did you notice her face? She's going to make it hard for me." The hotel lies back of a dingy passage and forms a rectangle very much on the order of a modern penitentiary. The bureau is large and gloomy, despite the brilliant reflections from the tile walls. There are bird cages hanging in the windows and little enamel signs everywhere, begging the guests in an obsolete language not to do this and not to forget that. It is almost immaculately clean, but absolutely poverty-stricken, threadbare, woebegone. The upholstered chairs are held together with wired thongs. They remind one unpleasantly of the electric chair. The room he is going to occupy is on the fifth floor. As we climb the stairs, Van Norden informs me that Maupassant once lived there, and in the same breath remarks that there is a peculiar odor in the hall. On the fifth floor, a few window panes are missing. We stand a moment, gazing at the tenants across the court. It is getting toward dinner time, and people are straggling back to their rooms with that weary, dejected air which comes from earning a living honestly. Most of the windows are wide open. The dingy rooms have the appearance of so many yawning mouths. The occupants of the rooms are yawning too, or else scratching themselves. They move about listlessly and apparently without much purpose. They might just as well be lunatics. As we turn down the corridor toward room 57, a door suddenly opens in front of us, and an old hag with matted hair and the eyes of a maniac peers out. She startles us so that we stand transfixed. For a full minute, the three of us stand there powerless to move or even to make an intelligent gesture. Back of the old hag, I can see a kitchen table, and on it lies a baby, all undressed, a puny little brat no bigger than a plucked chicken. Finally, the old one picks up a slop pail by her side and makes a move forward. We stand aside to let her pass, and as the door closes behind her, the baby lets out a piercing scream. It is room 56, and between 56 and 57 is the toilet where the old hag is emptying her slops. Ever since we have mounted the stairs, Van Norden has kept silence, but his looks are eloquent. When he opens the door of 57, I have, for a fleeting moment, the sensation of going mad. A huge mirror covered with green gauze and tipped at an angle of 45 degrees hangs directly opposite the entrance over a baby carriage, which is filled with books. Van Norden doesn't even crack a smile. Instead, he walks nonchalantly over to the baby carriage and, picking up a book, begins to skim it through, much as a man would enter the public library and go unthinkingly to the rack nearest to hand. And perhaps this would not seem so ludicrous to me if I had not espied at the same time a pair of handlebars resting in the corner. They look so absolutely peaceful and contented, as if they had been dozing there for years, that suddenly it seems to me as if we had been standing in this room, in exactly this position, for an incalculably long time, that it was a pose we had struck in a dream from which we never emerged, a dream which the least gesture, the wink of an eye even, will shatter. But more remarkable still is the remembrance that suddenly floats up of an actual dream which occurred only the other night, a dream in which I saw Van Norden in just such a corner as is occupied now by the handlebars, only instead of the handlebars there was a woman, crouching with her legs drawn up. I see him standing over the woman with that alert, eager look in his eye which comes when he wants something badly. The street in which this is going on is blurred. Only the angle made by the two walls is clear, and the cowering figure of the woman. I can see him going at her in that quick, animal way of his, reckless of what's going on about him, determined only to have his way. And a look in his eyes as though to say, "You can kill me afterwards, but just let me get it in. I've got to get it in." And there he is, bent over her, their heads knocking against the wall. He has such a tremendous erection that it's simply impossible to get it in her. Suddenly, with that disgusted air which he knows so well how to summon, he picks himself up and adjusts his clothes. He is about to walk away when suddenly he notices that his penis is lying on the sidewalk. It is about the size of a sawed-off broomstick. He picks it up nonchalantly and slings it under his arm. As he walks off, I notice two huge bulbs, like tulip bulbs, dangling from the end of the broomstick, and I can hear him muttering to himself, "Flower pots. Flower pots." The garçon arrives, panting and sweating. Van Norden looks at him uncomprehendingly. The madam now marches in, and walking straight up to Van Norden, she takes the book out of his hand, thrusts it in the baby carriage, and without saying a word, wheels the baby carriage into the hallway. "This is a bug house," says Van Norden, smiling distressedly. It is such a faint, indescribable smile that for a moment the dream feeling comes back, and it seems to me that we are standing at the end of a long corridor, at the end of which is a corrugated mirror. And down this corridor, swinging his distress like a dingy lantern, Van Norden staggers in and out, as here and there a door opens and a hand yanks him or a hoof pushes him out. And the further off he wanders, the more lugubrious is his distress. He wears it like a lantern, which the cyclists hold between their teeth on a night when the pavement is wet and slippery. In and out of the dingy rooms he wanders, and when he sits down the chair collapses. When he opens his valise, there is only a toothbrush inside. In every room there is a mirror before which he stands attentively and chews his rage. And from the constant chewing, from the grumbling and mumbling and the muttering and cursing, his jaws have gotten unhinged and they sag badly, and when he rubs his beard, pieces of his jaw crumble away, and he's so disgusted with himself that he stamps on his own jaw, grinds it to bits with his big heels. Meanwhile, the luggage is being hauled in, and things begin to look crazier even than before, particularly when he attaches his exerciser to the bedstead and begins his Sandow exercises. "I like this place," he says, smiling at the garçon. He takes his coat and vest off. The garçon is watching him with a puzzled air. He has a valise in one hand and the douchebag in the other. I'm standing apart in the antechamber, holding the mirror with the green gauze. Not a single object seems to possess a practical use. The antechamber itself seems useless, a sort of vestibule to a barn. It is exactly the same sort of sensation which I get when I enter the Comédie Française or the Palais Royal Theatre. It is a world of bric-a-brac, of trapdoors, of arms and busts and waxed floors, of candelabras and men in armor, of statues without eyes and love letters lying in glass cases. Something is going on, but it makes no sense. It's like finishing the half-empty bottle of Calvados because there's no room in the valise. Climbing up the stairs, as I said a moment ago, he had mentioned the fact that Maupassant used to live here. The coincidence seems to have made an impression upon him. He would like to believe that it was in this very room that Maupassant gave birth to some of those gruesome tales on which his reputation rests. "They lived like pigs, those poor bastards," he says. We are sitting at the round table in a pair of comfortable old armchairs that have been trussed up with thongs and braces. The bed is right beside us, so close indeed that we can put our feet on it. The armoire stands in a corner behind us, also conveniently within reach. Van Norden has emptied his dirty wash on the table. We sit there with our feet buried in his dirty socks and shirts and smoke contentedly. The sordidness of the place seems to have worked a spell on him. He is content here. When I get up to switch on the light, he suggests that we play a game of cards before going out to eat, and so we sit there by the window, with the dirty wash strewn over the floor and the Sandow exerciser hanging from the chandelier, and we play a few rounds of two-handed pinochle. Van Norden has put away his pipe and packed a wad of snuff on the underside of his lower lip. Now and then he spits out of the window, big healthy gobs of brown juice which resound with a smack on the pavement below. He seems content now. "In America," he says, "you wouldn't dream of living in a joint like this. Even when I was on the bomb, I slept in better rooms than this. But here it seems natural. It's like the books you read. If I ever go back there, I'll forget all about this life, just like you forget a bad dream. I'll probably take up the old life again just where I left off, if I ever get back. Sometimes I lie in bed, dreaming about the past, and it's so vivid to me that I have to shake myself in order to realize where I am, especially when I have a woman beside me. A woman can set me off better than anything. That's all I want of them, to forget myself. Sometimes I get so lost in my reveries that I can't remember the name of the cunt or where I picked her up. That's funny, eh? It's good to have a fresh, warm body beside you when you wake up in the morning. It gives you a clean feeling. You get spiritual-like until they start pulling that mushy.